If I may ask, Mr. Ingram has argued that he potentially raised a claim in one of two different places, either his original application or a later statement in support of claim. Let's just take that for its value. Does the fact that he might have a claim filed at a separate time than the application create any different obligations on the agency?
I think it changes. It does potentially change and become a distinguishing characteristic as to whether that's filed at the same time. In this appeal, where Section 3.150 requires that we see an application for pension as an application for compensation and the vice versa, it's the application form that forms the backbone of the application, or the form itself which forms the backbone of the application, and that is informed by, as we talked about at oral argument a year ago, by the documents that surrounded medical evidence and statements that come in. And so in this particular case, I don't see it as a separate, as a claims filed at different times. But it does raise, in other contexts, in other fact patterns, the possibility that different claims coming in at different points may arise and bring
And would that then be pursued under the unadjudicated claim theory, or would that follow some other form?
I think, look, it's hard to trace that. And reading Roberson through Andrews and Desotel, it doesn't really help us. It's hard to find a point from which to reckon through those and explain why one claim filed a little bit at a different time than another might be a separate track that would be termed as a pending claim, whereas another would be at the same time and go through an unadjudicated, deemed denied situation. So I don't think that the circuit's opinions necessarily answer the question very well. It raises possible areas of distinction, but I think in this case, those areas of distinction really aren't significant. I think the claims, if there were a claim, it's filed at exactly the same time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Once again, my name is Ari Michelson, representing Robert Ingram. Your Honors, I think that it may be worthwhile for just a moment to consider the facts in Desotel for just a moment, and likewise in Andrews a little bit, to make the point that one reading those cases can actually look at them and see that, in fact, there was notice in there, whereas there couldn't possibly have been notice in the Ingram case. Taking Desotel, what seemed to really bother the Federal Circuit was the fact that back in 1985, which is the time period for which Desotel was requesting that he be given benefits, he actually had a psychiatric examination. And he pursued two claims, one claim residuals of his head injury, and the other for his back and shoulder injury. Now, residuals of a head injury, and that coupled with a psychiatric examination, and further, that the RO's decision itself explicitly said that the VA exam shows no psychiatric symptomatology noted at present time, it may very well be that the Federal Circuit was looking at the facts here and saying, well, what these people are trying to do is really elevate form over substance. The decision didn't explicitly address a psychiatric claim, but it did note in general terms that psychiatric examination was performed and there was no indication that there was any psychiatric problem. And so in denying the claim partly, but not specifically addressing the psychiatric claim, in effect, one could say that there really was notice that the RO had considered the psychiatric claim. Likewise, in Andrews, as we know from Roberson, TDIU is essentially an implied claim that's directly related, and so a denial that doesn't specifically address TDIU implicitly addresses TDIU. And if you look at the language in Destatel, the Federal Circuit, in making its sweeping statement that we're here today discussing, the Federal Circuit specifically uses the word specifically. Where the veteran files more than one claim with the RO at the same time, the RO's decision acts favorably, unfavorably on one of the claims, but fails to specifically address the other claim, the second claim is deemed denied, and the appeal period begins to run. Now, the fact is that in Destatel, it appears as though there was a general addressing of the claim. In Ingram's case, however, there was no general discussion of the claim whatsoever. And unlike the case in Destatel, where the psychiatric claim was directly related to a head injury residual, the 1151 claim in the Ingram case is completely separate and apart from the pension claim. The elements are completely different. In the pension claim, you just got to have been, you know, in the war, and you've got to be totally disabled. But for the 1151 claim, there's an entirely different course of events where you've got to show causation, and possibly, depending on when you look at when the regulations came into effect, what was actually in effect at the time, fault. So a failure to address the 1151 claim is a complete and total and utter failure to address that claim whatsoever. There's not the same kind of connection that you have in the precedent. And so I'm not sure it's necessary to get all complicated and try to reconcile how Destatel can still leave unadjudicated pending claims alive or can't, and how the system can kind of work given what the Federal Circuit has said, when there's a much simpler way to cut through all of this. This court did a very comprehensive job in its decision in the Ingram case the first time around in explaining essentially all the various cases leading up to this point. And the only thing that remains is to understand where Destatel fits in. Well, if Destatel really has an implied notice, it doesn't change any of the jurisprudence that this court considered when it first looked at the Ingram case and decided it previously. So, to the bottom line here is that I think it's not necessary to be quite as complex in trying to reconcile a body of case law and decide whether or not Destatel is broad or narrow, when it's much easier to say that the unadjudicated pending claim doctrine remains alive. It was not directly addressed in Destatel, and moreover, Destatel relies on Andrews. Andrews relies on Roberson, and Roberson relies on Norris, which I say at least acknowledges Norris as being an informed and correct decision. And so the Federal Circuit certainly didn't seem to try to go out of its way to overturn precedent that, in fact, its own line of cases that it itself was citing relied upon that does consider an unadjudicated pending claim as a remaining doctrine. Okay, so that's really the be all and end all, I think, in terms of how to reconcile Destatel. Now, when you add on top of that the fact that the Federal Circuit completely ignored 3.103 and how it's evolved, and the fact that 3.103E is broader, as Mr. Ingram's brief makes clear, than the previous version of the statute, and does not address any of the due process arguments whatsoever, it gives further fodder, I think, for this court to feel satisfied that the Federal Circuit was not trying to go out of its way to undermine the unadjudicated pending claim, but was essentially annoyed by the fact that Mr. Destatel was elevating form over substance.
As attractive as your option may appear, let us assume that the Federal Circuit meant to go off in the direction that that the Secretary has advocated, that everything that's filed in one application gets one denial, and that was your opportunity to come back. How do we deal with that in Mr. Ingram's case?
Well, first of all, I think it's difficult to actually understand how the Federal Circuit could take such a position, since it seems to go exactly the opposite of Roberson itself, that essentially puts the onus on giving the benefit of the doubt to the veteran in interpreting what claims are actually there.
Right, but Mr. Roberson's case came up in the context of a Q claim.
That's true, but I'm not sure why that distinction is necessarily valid, because the body of veterans law is meant to inure to the benefit of the veteran and to give the benefit of the doubt to the veteran, why should that be any different in an unadjudicated pending claim context than in an acute claim context? Roberson certainly wasn't trying to draw that distinction. I'm not sure why this court would necessarily want to draw that distinction, especially since it essentially undermines that very policy. It's one thing to draw a distinction, it's another thing to actively undermine a policy. I don't see anything in the case law that, and certainly not in Roberson, that attempts to do that. Another hypothetical that might be worth considering, also in the context of this little paragraph that we're all here today discussing about that broad sweeping statement in Desitel. Desitel says, if you file more than one claim and you've got an action on one of the claims but not the other one, the other one's deemed denied. What about a scenario where you've got three claims? One of them is explicitly granted by the RO. A second claim is explicitly denied by the RO. And the third claim is not addressed. What do you do in that situation? How do you read Desitel in that situation to say that the third claim is deemed denied when one of the claims was actually granted? It doesn't really make sense to read Desitel as being that broad and sweeping in its undermining of the unadjudicated pending claim doctrine.
Counselor, do you have an opinion as to which statute or regulation the Federal Circuit may have been interpreting in Desitel?
I don't disagree with the Secretary's characterization of that, Your Honor. I don't think one needs to really go much further than that. And I don't think that the Federal Circuit was essentially trying to be as deep and sweeping and meaningful as we are all essentially trying to read into the Federal Circuit's decision in Desitel.
If we limit it, as you suggest, though, isn't it much more of a factual inquiry that the Federal Circuit has thrown itself into?
In what sense, Your Honor? I'm not sure I understand.
That it's trying to just to sift through the facts to determine whether a document might have discussed this other claim that may or may not have been filed.
Well, it's not something that the Federal Circuit would need to get into because the Federal Circuit could remand all the way down to make that determination.
But they chose, if we follow your line of reasoning, to say that he actually got notice by alluding to, by finding these comments in the record. So they're, like I'm saying, they're basically sifting through the facts to reach this outcome if we narrow it as limitedly as you
right.
suggest.
Right. I think I understand the question. I think that it's not so much there that the Federal Circuit is going through, sifting through the facts to determine whether or not there was implied notice. In a sense, I think it's reviewing the judgment below and seeing on those facts. I mean, it's not retrying the facts, but the facts are on the record and they are before the Federal Circuit on review, and they're simply looking at the plain facts and saying, you look at the plain facts and impliedly there was notice. I'm not sure how one goes about reaching a decision on a factual record without actually examining the facts and being able to say something about it. Obviously, there's deference, and an appellate court defers on a purely factual issue to the determination below. But again, it's deference. It's not complete deference. There's clear and convincing, or there's preponderance. There's some kind of standard that goes a little bit far, but still the Federal Circuit is going to do its own fact-finding, if you will, at least at some level, to come to a conclusion as to whether or not the court below was correct with respect to its factual finding. So it's not de novo review, but there is some measure of review of the facts, even in a situation like that. In truth, Your Honor, I'm happy to try and go further into reconciling the various cases that we've been talking about. And now the court specifically was interested, for example, in reconciling Moody with Desitel and all that. I'm happy to do that, but I think in view of the theory that I put forth here today, I'm not sure it's exactly necessary. It's kind of undermines the necessity to reconcile those cases, which in a way gives rise to a much more simple way of dealing with the Desitel problem. I'll also further add that if this court holds for Mr. Ingram once again, as it did the first time around, and in its decision were to further point out the distinction over Destel and the fact that the Destel decision does not address the 3.103 argument, does not address the due process argument, that at that level, at that point, if the Secretary wishes to then appeal to the Federal Circuit, it would at least give a forum for the Federal Circuit to address those very, very important issues and perhaps finally come to some conclusion on whether or not the unadjudicated pending claim doctrine continues to exist. On the other hand, if we simply broadly interpret Destel and say, well, that's it, the Federal Circuit's put down Destel, end of story, it's not going to flesh out and air the issues as completely. And moreover, if ultimately the case is not appealed, then I think there's a perfectly good way of reconciling the Federal Circuit case law so that this court need not go against what the Federal Circuit said, while at the same time adding to this court's jurisprudence that would maintain the unadjudicating pending claim doctrine in a way that inures to the benefit of the veteran. And I just might add, if I could, with your permission, Your Honors, that in today's climate especially, it's kind of fortuitous almost that the oral argument is today, this week, given what's in the news about the importance of veterans' benefits and making sure that veterans do get the benefit of the doubt, that's really the outcome that's most appropriate under the circumstances. If there is no further questions, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Let me ask you to go one step further. Let's assume that the court decides that it's not going to go for the easy answer here. Okay, I think it's a fair characterization. Let's say that the court feels like it's concerned about Moody and where Moody fits into all of this. Why don't you take it the next step, if you would, please, counsel, and talk about Moody.
Sure. I don't think it's necessary to see anything irreconcilable or inconsistent with Moody. Just, I guess, to review the facts there. First of all, Moody is a Q claim case, ultimately it was held that the court below had erred because it failed to read the claim sympathetically. Moody argued that it was Q for the RO in its 1996 decision, which held that the 1994 claim was the first time Moody had made his psychiatric claim in denying the earlier effective date, to find that no claim prior to the 1994 claim had been made. There was a simple factual question about whether or not that original pleading contained that additional claim. There was no further evidence that was necessary, and by simply blocking off the liberal reading of the claim, the tribunal below, the RO, basically had cut off the veteran at the pass, and the Moody court felt that it was just error to not read the claim sympathetically. That would be true whether it would be Q or whether it would be an unadjudicated pending claim. I don't see why there would be any reason to make a distinction of one versus the other. I'm not sure that there's any reason to read Moody any more into Moody, essentially, than that. But Moody, of course, stands for a very basic and important principle that would be totally undermined by a broad reading of Destel, that we need to give a broad reading and give the veteran the benefit of the doubt when he presents a claim for benefits.
Thank you. Counsel for Secretary, I think you have your whole 10 minutes. Or did you reserve 5?
I think I reserved 5. Right?
That's why you have so much. Okay.
Your Honor, we feel that the Secretary feels that Destel applies, that the only way to focus on the statutes and regs and to make distinctions along those lines is a way of saying Destel doesn't apply. That we should just push it off to the side as sort of a odd case. It isn't. It comes up in a specific context. It comes up in a line of cases, but its holdings, especially with when read in conjunction with Roberson and Andrews, clearly indicates the Federal Circuit is seeing this as a broader.
Why, if we read Destel as you have told us that we ought, that it eliminates, in many respects, this idea of the pending unadjudicated claim, and we walk back from Des Hotel to Andrews to Roberson, and then Roberson's discussion of this court's decision in Norris, then if that's all part of the line of cases, how can we then say that Des Hotel somehow stands for something broader and yet it didn't discuss the pending unadjudicated claim in the context of Norris?
Well, as the court noted in Ennis' decision in Ingram, and created, focused on a distinction that Roberson made of Norris on one side and Roberson and Andrews on the other. And the focus was on Norris, where the informal claim arose after the initial scheduler rating had been assigned and become final. And now there's a claim for IR with an implied claim of TDIU, with the Roberson-Andrews line coming prior to that point. And certainly the circuit focused on that. But even if we accept that distinction, as we've noted before, there are several areas in which future litigation can flush out the dynamics of this. But even if we were to accept that distinction, Mr. Ingram's appeal falls squarely within the Roberson, Andrews, Des Hotel line of cases. It's the original application, just as it was in Andrews, just as it was in Roberson, all prior to the assignment of any scheduler rating, which is the distinction the circuit focused on, which this court focused on in Ingram. So yes, there are ways of distinguishing it, but Des Hotel really covers the waterfront in this particular case.
Let me ask you this. You just alluded to future litigation kind of setting the parameters. Isn't there a role for the secretary to play in all of this, and can't the secretary decide whether or not there's such a thing as a pending unadjudicated claim, and isn't there a place where he can regulate here, or do you think it's all appropriated by the federal circuit now?
No, obviously the secretary can regulate, the Congress can legislate in this area, but the point in this particular litigation is the effect of Des Hotel on this particular case, given the dynamics that are here today. There are, I don't know of any particular efforts by the secretary or what options may be available or being considered regarding this in a regulatory sense or even in a legislative sense. So I don't have much to say. There is an opportunity, though, obviously, for regulatory or legislative action.
Well, I guess the next question in my mind is, hadn't the secretary already done that? And the fact that the Federal Circuit didn't discuss the secretary's regulations in great depth, doesn't that give this court the opportunity to believe what the secretary has said in his regulations and accept that as the secretary's scheme?
Well, as we mentioned before, the Federal Circuit's holding in Des Hotel is clearly tied to what we believe is a reference, at least to the statutory basis on which the regulations on notice and adjudication are based, and the appellate system within the department is based. There's no way around the fact that there isn't a specific discussion in there, an exhaustive discussion of all of the regulations and all. The Secretary's position, though, is that the Circuit understood what it was doing with notice, that it understood the effect of what it was doing. And that is why the holding is as broad as it is.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
It's difficult. Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's difficult for me to understand how one could actually believe that the Federal Circuit understood the broad implications of what it was doing with Des Hotel when the decision itself seems to speak of annoyance with the particular circumstances of that case, where there were numerous indications in the record that Mr. Des Hotel had been psychologically examined and so on. The Federal Circuit is well aware that the system itself, the veteran system, while it should inure to the benefit of the
Counselor,
veteran.
Counselor, if I can interrupt you, you know,
yes,
and I will candidly admit on the record that I, seeing you get up there as the appellant's counsel, I said to myself, well, okay, the appellant's counsel has rebuttal. I guess we didn't give you rebuttal opportunity, given the fact that the secretary is the movement here. There's no reason why this court couldn't suspend its own generalized rules for argument, but it seems to me that the case has been argued and rebuttal has been submitted, and absent objection from my colleagues, I think I'm regretfully going to have to cut you off.
I understand, Your Honor, and I appreciate the time I've had here. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be submitted for consideration, and the court, before adjourning, will come down and greet counsel.